found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're listening live, good morning to you. You can just minimize us on your computer screen wherever you are. You can also take us with you. We're mobile. There are free apps that you can download to your so that you can carry our program on your iPhone and or your Android or your tablet. And so whatever way you're finding us, we thank you for your appearance here in our lives. It's Thursday morning. The date is May 9th, and we are live. There are the five stories that you need to know about. We will go through those, and we spend about 3 to 4 hours going through the stories that happen so that we can distill them down to five so that you can take those with you for the rest of your day. And if you're listening for us to us later, they're still relevant because it was what was going on at the time of Monday morning, May 9th. On the program this morning, we have a guest who's going to be speaking to us about distracted driving. He taught traffic school for 25 years. We'll find out if he's still teaching it. He thought he would do it for 6 months, and he's still doing it. Distracted driving is in the news this week. We'll share that story with you and why. And then it's about state and federal data that's been compiled by the National Safety Council and the underreporting of traffic accidents that are fatal and how the cell phone use is contributing to that. But obviously the biggest story this morning is that this depraved devil who has the name of Ariel Castro was arraigned this morning. He was moved from city jail to county jail, and this is the 52-year-old Cleveland man who's accused of holding three women captive. The prosecution asked for $5 million bail, and the judge said, no, $8 million. So he said $2 million for each. So there were the three women and the six-year-old daughter of one of the women. The brothers were also arraigned this morning, but their names apparently are kind of being cleared, if you will. They were arraigned on unrelated misdemeanor charges. Pedro Castro, 54, was released after pleading no contest to an open container charge filed in July 2011. He was fined $100. And the other brother, O'Neill Castro, who is 50, was released after Judge Lauren Moore dismissed charges of drug abuse and having an open container that were filed in November 2001. Of course, the courtroom was packed this morning with reporters and cameras, so no one in the public was able to fit in to attend. The three women, Amanda Berry, Michelle Knight, and Gina De Jesus, were confined. They were first put in the basement, they're alleging, and bound and chained, and then he allowed them, after he realized what kind of control he could have over them, to stay in locked rooms upstairs. And there were apparently holes, like the doors were bolted and locked on the outside, but there were holes that he could pass food into them when he felt like it. They were allowed out twice in the 10 years that they were captive, and that those two times they went to his detached garage. They had to put on sunglasses, wigs, and a hat. Barry and her six-year-old daughter and De Jesus returned to their family's homes yesterday. Michelle Knight was in the hospital still. It's reports are out that Michelle was pregnant up to five times. And what Ariel would do, he would starve her, and then he would beat her in the stomach until she miscarried. So these poor gals, I cannot imagine what their recovery is going to be like. And if you are a praying person, pray for them, please. Now, the man who they say, they call him a micro-celebrity, Charles Ramsey, we spoke about him yesterday, he's the one that rescued them. He heard the pounding. This poor guy now, his past is coming to the present. He's a convicted felon. His rap sheet has three separate domestic violence convictions that resulted in prison terms. He also had he had also served in the 90s for, he had two separate one-year stretches for convictions for drug abuse, criminal trespassing, and receiving stolen property. Well, his first domestic violence charge came in February 1997. He pleaded no contest a year later and was found guilty. While waiting to be sentenced, he was again arrested for domestic violence in July 1998. And as a result, he was jailed for violating the terms of his release on the bond. So he entered a no-contest plea in the second case and was again found guilty. Then he was busted a third time for domestic abuse in January 2003. So that was when he was indicted for a felony, domestic violence with prior conviction. His victim was his wife at the time, Rochelle. The couple got married on Valentine's Day in 1995. They have a child together who's 15. So after pleading guilty to the felony abuse charge, he was sentenced to 8 months in prison. And following his release, he was placed on a post-release control supervision for the maximum term allowable by Ohio law. Now, his ex-wife, Rochelle, secured a divorce from him when he was locked up, and he eventually apologized to her for battering her. And her statement is, the only thing is he never paid child support, which was mandated at $51 per month in the divorce decree. The county has taken his driving privileges away for non-support. So she says she has an okay relationship with Ramsey, but their daughter has a rockier relationship with him and has even carefully cut out her father out of the many photos taken at her parents' wedding. But yesterday, talk about the power of Facebook. This woman, Rochelle Ramsey, she posted pictures, two pictures, on her Facebook page along with the caption, "For my daughter's sake, to show he didn't always look good, the young Charles Ramsey." So there's Facebook in our lives in that regard. Okay, yesterday the jury found Jody Arias guilty of first-degree murder. She's returning to court today to begin a phase that's called aggravation phase. And that's where the jurors are going to decide whether they give her the death penalty or what. So Jody did a television interview minutes after the verdict was announced and said she'd prefer a death sentence. Her quote, "I said years ago that I'd rather get death than life, and that is still true today." She says her family has long-living genes, and she doesn't want to live the rest of her life in prison. So crowds erupted in cheers after the jury's decision yesterday. And again, forgiveness is in the news this week. We've spoken about it, I think, every day. A friend of Travis Alexander, Alicia Chabelle, says, "It's not going to bring Travis back. He was such a light to this world, and it's important that we forgive Jody so she doesn't have that power to destroy our lives." We had on a woman this week who started something called the Forgiveness Project. If you didn't get a chance to listen to that, you might. She talks about the power of forgiveness and what it does to people when they give it, if you will, or acknowledge it, or let that emotion flood over them. It's the Forgiveness Project. And then the voters in South Carolina apparently forgave former Governor Mark Sanford because they elected him in the special election to the House. And then there's this Pennsylvania mother who abandoned her family 11 years ago. And the daughter says, "I don't want to see her. I hope she rots in hell, and I hope someday that I'll be able to forgive her." So all forgiveness in there. So what the jury is going to do today, with the aggravation phase, the prosecutors get a chance to present additional evidence, and then the jurors will decide whether Travis Alexander's death was caused in a cruel manner. And if they decide that that was the case, the trial moves to the penalty phase, where the jurors could decide whether Arias should receive the death sentence. This is something interesting to note. If the jury decides on the death sentence, the judge has to honor that decision. But if the jury decides against the death penalty, the judge gets two choices: sentencing her to life in prison without the possibility of parole, or sentencing her to life in prison with the possibility of parole after at least 25 years. So there are 127 people on death row in Arizona. If Arias is given the death sentence, she would be the fourth woman on death row in the state. The jurors deliberated for 15 hours and 5 minutes, and then they get to speak after this part of it. So it'll be interesting to see what they have to say about that. So Jody Arias has been put on suicide watch. Also, the monster Ariel Castro has been on that watch as well. So Tamerlan Tsarnaev, his body was in limbo because nobody was in the United States was willing to take him. Early this morning, the parents were saying that they were thinking about either having his body flown back or, even though it's against Islamic law, they were going to try and have him cremated and then have the ashes flown back. But that has since become a moot point because later this morning, it was revealed by the authorities in Worcester. They said a courageous and compassionate person stepped forward and they have buried him. And it is not being released where that's going to be, but it's outside of Worcester. So what the Tsarnaev family was going to have to fight against is that Russia has a policy of not giving the bodies of terrorists or even suspected terrorists back to their families for burial for fear the grave would become a shrine. So instead, they are usually buried anonymously by the government in an undisclosed location, and that's true of the remains, whether it's the body or the ashes. And this policy was enacted in 1996, and it's because of their long and violent struggle against terrorism. So that became a non-issue. And then on a lighter note, there's something called, there are cicadas, which you may be familiar with. They have a most amazing life journey. And I've been in contact with a chief entomologist in Connecticut to see if he can be a guest on our program to help explain this. But what happens is this year, this month, or early next month, they are arriving, cicadas, billions of them, along about a 900-mile stretch from North Georgia to upstate New York. And what's so amazing about this? Because it happens every 17 years. So, and they are not a hassle or a problem. They do not sting or bite. They aren't harmful to crops. They may cause damage to young, small trees or shrubs if too many of them feed on them or too many lay their eggs. So after they mate, the females lay their eggs. The eggs hatch later in the season. The nymphs, as they're known, drop to the ground, burrow underground, and restart the 17-year cycle. So what they're doing now is they are digging themselves up. So every 17th year, a few weeks before emerging, the cicadas build exit tunnels to the surface, and when the soil temperature exceeds 64 degrees Fahrenheit, they leave their burrows, usually after sunset. They settle on a nearby tree or shrub, and start their final molt to adulthood. So this man that we've been in contact with, who's an entomologist, this is his third time of studying their emergence. He tracked them in 1979, and again in 1996, and they're not due next until 2030, when he'll be 81 years old. So we were emailing back and forth this morning because he's on the East Coast, and he's like, I assume you're coming to me. I don't really have time. I was like, no, it's a radio interview, so and you just need to be near a phone. He goes, well, you know, Maria, I've been waiting 17 years for this, so I don't know if I'm going to have the time. I was like, okay, but we can talk on the telephone, and so anywhere you are, we can have a conversation. So he, I'll keep you posted to see if that happens. And now we're going to call our guest about distracted driving and see what he has to say about that. And we are dialing.
Morning, Maria.
Good morning, Reed Berry. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for taking the time to visit with us this morning. Now, before we get into the topic that's making news this week, which it always is, about distracted driving, give us a brief overview of your history and how you came to be 25 years later talking with me.
Well, you know what? I've been in traffic safety for that long. That's something I didn't really know I was going to do. It was not something I really wanted to do, but I had started doing a radio show at the time, and there was a guy who I knew that owned the first comedy traffic school in California, and he kept telling me, hey, you're a funny guy, and you're very knowledgeable. Why don't you start teaching traffic school for me? So eventually I gave in, assuming I'd do it for about 6 or 8 months, make a little extra money, and now 25 years later, I'm still teaching traffic school now for the National Traffic Safety Institute.
And do you get to do comedy with them or no?
Well, I do. NTSI is not a comedy traffic school. We take safe driving very seriously. But, you know, the way to get the point across on any subject matter, even serious subject matter, is to temper it a little bit with some humor. So, sure, I do that in class, and the people have a good time. They remember what they learn, and everybody comes out a winner.
Now, the one time that I took comedy traffic school, and it's been, gosh, 8-10 years ago. Fortunately, that's the last time I got cited. They said that about 80% of all accidents are based on excessive speeds. Is that still true?
Yeah, that is actually true. Most people don't think about it, but ask any police officer and they will tell you that most collisions and many other traffic violations also stem from excessive speed.
And you would think that it would be other things like inebriation or road rage or, you know, something else that is like situational, not just excessive speeds.
Right. Well, people drive too fast. You know, when the speed limit, during that period when the speed limit was 55, after a big gas crisis of decades ago, people would drive 65. And then when they raise it back to 65, people drove 75. And so, you know, you can make the speed limit 100 miles an hour and somebody will still go 110 or 120 because they're better than we are and they get to do it because they have a nicer car or a faster car or they just have a sense of entitlement for some reason.
And I rode my Harley last August to Sturgis with 9 other riders. And when we were, I think it was in Utah, they had 80 mile an hour speed limits. And in a couple other states that we went through, and it's like, wow, I wonder how they got that passed, or do you know what circumstances describe what speed should be on what thoroughfares?
Yeah, well, I mean, for a while, Montana had no speed limit at all. They just said drive whatever's safe on the highway. But, you know, everybody's going, well, I think 100's safe. I think 150 is safe in my Mercedes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got out of control, so they actually put a speed limit up now. But one thing in other states and other areas that they don't have to deal with that we do here in California is the tremendous amount of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's why you hear so much about road rage and aggressive driving out here, because we just have over 20 million licensed drivers on the road, not to mention all the ones that are unlicensed, and over 27 million registered vehicles in California. So you put that together with, you know, just not enough roads, and you got a whole lot of cars here. So we deal with issues here that they don't do in other places. So based on states with lighter traffic or more freeways or better road conditions, yeah, sometimes they'll raise the speed limit to 70 or 80.
And the Autobahn, is it still without speed limits as well? Do you know?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, it is. I've never driven on the Autobahn, and it's not the kind of thing you'd want to, you know, get on there in a Toyota Yaris or something, but you really have to kind of have the car that's designed to drive those speeds. But, you know, like I tell people, the nice thing about driving on the Autobahn is if you get into a crash, there's not really any cars to tow away. You just kind of sweep up the dust.
That's nice. That was when my eldest son had an incident when he was first at 16. He was following a buddy back to the house because he was tutoring his friend. And the guy started going faster, and so, you know, testosterone kicks in. And so he's drafting behind, and fortunately they got caught because that was a big, bad, good early lesson. And the officer, they called me to come because they were impounding the car, and the officer complimented me on my son's manners, and I said, thank you very much. And he said, and so are the dead ones. So it was like, okay, you know, he put that in perspective.
Good point, right?
Yep. So fortunately, that was a lesson learned early and well and without any tragedy involved. So I was, you know, it's like that stuck with all of us for the rest of our lives. So, Reed, let's talk about distracted driving, because everything in the news with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's database is saying that the distracted driving with the use of a cell phone is completely underreported.
Well, it is. And, you know, this, by the way, is, and I don't know if you realize this, but the 5-year anniversary of the cell phone law here in California. And you'd think by now people would get it, and they really don't get it. When the law was brand new 5 years ago, people were kind of careful at first. They were not using the phones. You saw everybody wearing their Bluetooth headset, and people were taking it seriously. And then as time went on, they're going, I don't want to use that headset anymore. Now they're just holding the phone like they always used to. And I went into a traffic court one day just as an observer to see what was going on in there, and all but one of the cases being heard that day were cell phone cases. So, you know, it's a widespread problem, and it's something people cannot do safely. I used to maintain the position it shouldn't be legislated. People should just be better educated, do it safely, etc. But then people have proven time and time again over the years they can't do it safely. You're holding the phone, you're engaged in a conversation that, if it's an emotional conversation, imagine driving on the freeway and then, you know, calling to break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend, mm-hmm. you know, or receiving horrible family news that a family member passed away. Your focus is on that call and not on driving. So that's where the problem is. Then you have texting. That's a whole other matter. And then in his infinite wisdom, Governor Jerry Brown signs a law allowing texting again in cars as long as it's voice interactive and hands-free. Well, this law is just enough to confuse everyone. And they come into my class and go, oh, I heard texting is legal again. No, it's not legal again. It's only legal if, I think this is a case where the law is maybe ahead of the technology to some degree, because most phones can't do this yet, but as long as you can text completely voice-activated and hands-free, it's legal. Otherwise, it's not.
But I'd have never done that, but I understand from folks who do that, if you don't reread what it thought it heard you say, there's a lot of misstatements made. So that would suggest then that somebody is going to look at the phone before they push send, which means that they're distracted again.
Well, it is a distraction. You know, I read car reviews, and I was invited to a press junket for a certain car that, you know, they were very proud of this new car, and they said it had voice interactive technology, and we're driving down the street, and the next place we were going to go on our little tour was an art gallery. And so it was a Ford car. The guy from Ford said, just say gallery, and it will direct us there automatically. So I said gallery, and the thing repeats back to me, sandwich? And it's like, and he said, do it again. I said gallery, and it goes, sandwich? And it's like, okay, now how distracting is this? I'm trying to get to an art gallery. It's trying to direct me to Subway. What's the deal? It's not understanding what I'm saying. So this voice recognition is not spot on. And, yeah, that could be more distracting than simply dialing or texting a number or texting a person, you know.
Well, and my car has a GPS system that allows me to utilize it while I'm driving. And so if I'm lost or something and I don't want to pull over, which I am guilty of, I'm pushing, you know, buttons on my screen there to get it to get me to the right place. And that's not illegal.
Well, it's not illegal. Is it illegal or not? Could you get a ticket for it? Actually, you could.
And what would be the citation?
And it would be for vehicle code 22350, which is the basic speed law in California, which says you may not drive faster than is safe for conditions. So in other words, if a police officer looks over and sees you typing into your GPS device and he thinks it's unsafe at the speed you're driving, there's no GPS ticket, so he will give you a speeding ticket under the basic speed law. And that's the same way they ticket people for putting on makeup, for talking, not talking on the phone, they have a law for that, but putting on makeup, eating food, drinking a beverage, controlling unrestrained pets in cars. If you're doing something in the car while driving that makes the speed you're driving unsafe, they will use vehicle code 22350 and give you a ticket for speeding.
So if a dog is sitting on a driver's lap with their head out the window, you can be cited for that?
If the officer considers it to be unsafe, if the dog is just sitting there minding itself. Now, we don't recommend having the dog in your lap because pets, like people, like children, should be restrained in your vehicle for safety. But, you know, I've seen people, I saw a dog riding with a parrot on his shoulder. I've seen people, you know, pushing their cats into the back seat. If you're doing something trying to control animals while driving, that could look dangerous to a police officer. That could result in a ticket. But if a dog is just sitting in your lap behaving itself, probably wouldn't be a problem. But again, we recommend having them restrained for safety in any event.
So, Reed, I've never heard of somebody getting cited for eating in the car. Did you encounter that in your years with traffic school?
Oh, sure. And in fact, last month, April was distracted driving month, and they were ticketing people for that. You know, and people, it blows people away when I mention this in my classes, that you can get ticketed for things like that. You know, and you get, you know, smart aleck responses like, what, there's a burrito law? What, there's a burger law? Well, no, there's no actual burger law, burrito law, but they will ticket you under that basic speed law that I mentioned previously. Because that's just kind of a blanket violation. They get you for anything you're doing in the car. Because I know I've seen it, and I know you have too, when you look over the car and see somebody tipping this big plastic cup up in front of their face trying to get the last sip of their Slurpee. And that cup is practically covering their whole face. Mm. I don't know how they're seeing you drive down the road.
Now, that's a good point. I could see that being an issue, but I've never heard about somebody eating. I mean, I don't get eating in the car and driving myself, but I understand people do it all the time. But I didn't realize that you can get cited for that. So you're saying that the officer is interpreting what is safe and what is unsafe. I wonder how that holds up in court, though.
Well, it does, because in court, a police officer is considered an expert witness. And unless you can really prove that the officer maybe he didn't see you, maybe he was on a motorcycle wearing a helmet, it was a hot day, and he was sweating and perspiration was dripping in his face, I don't know how you would, you know, what you could possibly say that would win over a police officer's testimony in court. But, they, you know, it's like a lot of things out there on the road. It is the police officer's call.
And what has been, in your estimation, aside from speeding, that you see people in schools for?
I'm sorry, it was what?
In your estimation, as a teacher of traffic school, aside from speed, what are the other more common complaints that people are there for?
Well, unsafe lane changes, a lot of red light runners, a lot of stop sign runners. And then, of course, with the red light runners, it's always somebody else's fault, whether it's the, you know, another driver, the police officer, the camera. Why do they have to put cameras at those corners? It's not fair. Well, it's fair. I mean, I debated this with somebody else on a radio show one time, and it was a city councilman in Texas, and he said he didn't think the cameras are fair. I said, you know what? I don't care if they put those cameras at every corner in America, because I don't run red lights, so I'm never going to get a ticket for doing that. You only have to worry about the penalty if you commit that violation.
What
and
about?
I don't do that. I don't run red lights.
The kind where you trip it, but you stop. Are those enforceable? In other words, you've
here's the thing, and what most people don't realize is they don't mail out 100% of the tickets. When those photo cameras are taking pictures, the police officers actually have to go through each and every photo to determine who will actually get a ticket. And if you actually trip the sensor but then stop at the light, they generally won't mail that out. And some cities report mailing as low as, you know, 30 or 40% of the tickets, some as high as, you know, 70 or 80% of the tickets, but no city mails out 100%.
Oh, so there's interpretation there too then?
Correct.
Okay. That's good to know. I don't think that I've ever heard that before.
Yep, absolutely, and it's the only way to make it fair. I mean, you know, there are extenuating circumstances for anything, and in fact, there was a case that was in the news where a girl had run a red light camera. She went into court to fight the ticket, and she told the judge, yes, I did run the red light. Yes, I did get this ticket. And she said, but the reason why is because there was a man running towards my car, and I feared for my safety. And then the judge looked at the picture and could see the guy in the picture approaching her car. And he said, oh, hey, good point. Case dismissed.
Oh.
So, you know, I mean, it does happen. And so, yeah, there is an interpretation there. And so just the fact that you, you know, go through an intersection, you may see that flash of light. That light could be flashing to take a picture of some other car. It may have flashed you, but it didn't work properly. That's been a problem, too, in certain cities. One city had to dismiss thousands of tickets because they found out the camera equipment wasn't working properly. So just the fact that you see a flash of light as you're passing through the intersection doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a ticket. But point is, got to stop at the limit line before you proceed through if you're making a right turn. And if you're approaching an intersection and you see the light turn yellow, don't go, hey, that's my color, and hit the gas pedal and try to make it. That yellow light means, hey, you know, cover the brake, be prepared to stop when you get to the intersection because the light's going to change to red. We all know the sequence by now, green, yellow, red, mm-hmm. And then when you see the yellow light, You know, it's are you feeling lucky, as Clint Eastwood would say? You know, you might want to stop and avoid the ticket.
And the other thing about I noticed being a Harley rider is that people seem to want to speed up anytime I put my blinker on. So I've been told by my fellow hog riders, they said only put your blinker on as you're making the lane change or you're making your turn. Because for whatever reason, I don't know what would compel somebody to want to cut you off when you're more vulnerable than most and you're giving them the dignity of letting them know what you're doing. So I don't know if there's...
You feel that way, as do I, but a lot of people like to play road games with other drivers, and for some reason there's a lot of negativity from car drivers towards motorcycle riders, and I don't understand it, but the law says you have to use your signal whenever you change lanes or change direction, and you have to signal 100 feet before changing lanes, so you really have to give a little advance notice. You can't just put it on as you're changing the lane. So, unfortunately, that's what you have to do according to the law, and even more unfortunately, car drivers like to play games like that with people.
Yeah, because my mom even has a friend. She says, as soon as I see an indicator go on, I speed up. It's like she admits to the fact that she's being like, what is that about? I'll never forget.
We've already found one of the culprits there. Now we just have to pinpoint all the others out there on the road.
So, Reed, one of the quotes that I wanted to share with you, and this is from the president and CEO of the National Safety Council. Her name's Janet Feucher. She says, we believe the number of crashes involving cell phone use is much greater than what is being reported. And they give, for example, large variations among states in reporting phone-involved fatal crashes. Tennessee reported far more fatal crashes involving cell phones used than any other state, 93 in 2011 and 71 in 2010. California, the nation's most populous state, reported only 22 fatal crashes involving cell phones. And New York, which has three times as many people as Tennessee, reported one cell phone-involved fatal crash in 2011. So they're saying part of the problem is that if somebody dies, they can't tell you that they were on the phone. And or when people, the police are investigating the accident, there's not necessarily a box that you can check off that said cell phone, you know, appearance of cell phone use or something like that. So they are trying to get that streamlined so that it is then able to be tracked and then we can figure out just exactly what is going on.
Well, yeah, in more and more cases now, they're actually checking people's cell phone records, but it's true. I mean, if most people cause a crash, you're going to jump out and say, hey, it was on my phone. Although I will say, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was rear-ended on the freeway by a lady in an old beat-up Buick, so she probably didn't care anyway. But she rear-ended me and then got out of the car and said, oh, my gosh, you realize it was on my phone making a call. Well, most people so... Yeah, I can understand it would be underreported, and most people wouldn't stop to doing it if they did.
Right. And it came about because a 17-year-old girl was talking on her cell phone to a friend and said, I'm going to crash. She did crash. She died at the hospital without regaining consciousness. The cell phone ended up in the back seat of the car, so of course no one thought that it was part of it, but her mother did some investigation, pulled the records down exactly like you were talking about. You got to do some investigating. And so she's exactly. The one that's leading this crusade to try and get us to be more accountable with that, which she got the changes made in her state, which, you know, at least there was some good resolution. Not much, but that happened.
That's fantastic. You know, when you think about it, we have enough distractions in our cars. And I was at a car show over the weekend over in Beverly Hills at Greystone Mansion. And when you look at old classic cars, what do you see inside? Well, there's a steering wheel and pedals and some seats and maybe an AM radio. That's all we had going on. Now when you buy a car, you've got satellite radio, AM, FM, a CD changer, backup cameras, you've got USB capabilities, you've got iPod connectivity. So we have enough distractions going on in our cars nowadays anyway. Then you throw a cell phone into the mix or trying to text or whatever you're doing. And, I mean, you know, it's just a recipe for disaster. And most people follow other cars too closely. So, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, hey, if I'm too close to that car right there and I look down to see where I spilled my jelly donut, or I, you know, look down to dial a number, and the car in front of me stops, guess what? You're not going to have time to react to that. So, you know, put all these distractions together with your people drive too fast and follow too close. That's where the problem comes in, especially here in California.
Reed, I would imagine with you having 25 years of teaching traffic school and hearing everything that you do, that you would, are you probably very cautious knowing all that can go wrong?
Yeah, very cautious. And if you don't believe me, ask anyone who rides with me. And it's not a matter of being, you know, cautious to the point of, you know, being freaked out about it. I'm a very relaxed driver because, A, I enjoy driving. That's another thing, too. If you have somebody who doesn't enjoy driving, their fuse is going to be a little shorter and it's not going to take much to set them off. But I enjoy driving, but I'm watching everybody and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm checking my mirrors frequently. Mm-hmm. I'm looking over my shoulder. I know what's going on in every lane around me on the freeway. I'm watching, you know, cross traffic. In fact, one time I was on my way to a radio station to do a radio show. And we were going to have Steve Allen on that day, the late Steve Allen, brilliant man. But we're going to have Steve on the show that day. And on the way to the studio, I'm sitting at a red light. The light turns green rather than just going on green. And green doesn't mean go, means go when safe. So rather than just going, I happen to check the cross street, and here comes an elderly woman through the red light on the cross street, looking down and lighting a cigarette.
Oh, boy.
So had I gone, of course, it gave me something great to talk about on the air that day.
Yeah. Unless,
but had I gone, I mean, you know, the lady would have broadsided me, and, you know, even if you're not injured in an accident, what else results from that? A lot of inconvenience. You got to wait for a tow truck. You have to deal with insurance companies. And who needs the hassle? It's easier just to drive safely.
So, Reed, contact information to share?
Yeah, well, my like I say, teach for National Traffic Safety Institute. The website there is ntsi.com. And then my website is reedberry, R-E-E-D-B-E-R-R-Y.com.
Excellent, Reed. Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciated the conversation.
Thanks, Maria. Drive safely.
You're welcome. I will. Thank you so much. And speaking of cell phone, before we get into our next guest, there's something that came up this week in San Francisco, and I kind of discounted it because, you know, they're a little loonies sometimes up there. But the Board of Supervisors voted this week to revoke an ordinance that was the first in the country that they enacted in 2011 that would have required retailers to warn consumers about the potentially dangerous radiation levels in cell phones. So the reason that they gave the Board of Supervisors for revoking it is because there was going to be attorney fees, and if the city lost, then the judge was going to award the group that challenged it as much as $500,000 in attorney fees, and they didn't feel like they were in a position that they could do that. So what I didn't know, though, that came out from the story, and this the lawsuit, the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association is the one that got a permanent injunction against the Right to Know cell phone ordinance. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, considers they have radiation levels that they adopted in 1996, and it hasn't been revisited since then. So last month, they agreed to consider revising its 17-year-old guidelines. Hello, technology has changed. Obviously, what was then is not now. Because the World Health Organization cancer experts have said that mobile phones, quote, are possibly carcinogenic. And there's a woman who in the area was an advocate for the measure because she said her husband suffers from a brain tumor on the same side of his head to which he most often held his mobile phone. We'll take it now to Southern California. There is a physician, Dr. Gabriel Zada, a neurosurgery professor at the USC, University of Southern California, Keck School of Medicine. He found in a 2012 study, so we're talking recent, that the age-adjusted incidence of malignant tumors in the parts of the brain closest to where people hold their phones rose significantly from 1992 and 2006 in California. But he says that he couldn't draw any conclusions about the dangers of cell phones in his findings, but I'm thinking, why not? So we're going to try and get him on the program, too, to see what he has to say about that. But in any event, the FCC obviously needs to revise their 17-year-old guidelines. I don't know if you had a cell phone when they first came out. I had one. It was a brick. And, you know, obviously now they're smaller. But who knows? If they haven't tested things in 17 years, that suggests that that would be problematic. So we are calling John White, our next guest, because we like to promote things that are happening around the county in Ventura if we can. And that doesn't mean that we don't talk about state, national, and international news. But here's something fun that you might want to take advantage of tomorrow.
Sylvia?
Maria?
Yes, it's Maria Sanchez. You're live on the Maria Sanchez Show. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm terrific. Sylvia is the proprietor of the Sylvia White Gallery that's having an event tomorrow, and we wanted to help promote it so that folks, if they're looking for something to do, they can stop on in.
We would love that. The performance series is directed by John White, and I'm going to let you talk to him. Hold
okay.
on a sec.
Thank you, Sylvia. John White is the director.
Hello.
Hi, John. It's Maria Sanchez. You're live on the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
We wanted to help get the word out about your 5 years in Ventura at your 555, and hopefully you can explain what it is and what where you are and what people might be able to see.
Okay. Well, let's get started.
Okay.
The 5x5x5 actually defines how the evening goes. Five artists will do five pieces, one each. So each artist has 5 minutes to do something. And it's non-theatrical, and it's off the proscenium, and there's and basically no acting involved and no projections and no proscenium. So it's done in the gallery. And I call it performance art. It's something that I've done all my life and sort of retired in the 80s, and then we moved up here in Ventura, and I realized that there was some interest in performance art, and so I started up this series. We've been doing it for 5 years. It's been pretty successful, and it's fast and furious. Okay, I mean, people are here at 8 o'clock, and we're out of here by about 9:15, and we have everything from people rolling on the ground, throwing sticks in the air, to doing a kid-friendly striptease burlesque in the window, somebody driving up in a truck and having a gigantic 15-by-15-foot television that doesn't have a front to it, and they sort of perform, and the audience watches it. And then the audience comes in, and nobody sits. They all kind of stand and move from space to space or site to site in our gallery. Okay.
So, wait,
how
John,
am I doing?
Good, but I want to back up because people might not understand the distinction between, you said there's not acting going on, and it's performance art. Can you explain what performance art is?
Well, in a sense, the way I see it, I mean, there are several people see it differently, but and it's not anti-theater, which is some people think it's some people that think that I'm against theater, but I'm not. But it's done differently, and it's primarily from sculptural and performance and painters that do these things. And but it's live, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it can be anything from abstract sounds to abstract music to abstract movement to, as I suggested earlier, one of my favorite pieces was somebody was on the ground throwing white bones up in the air and talking. Okay. it sounds bizarre, but he did it right. And then I had someone come in and stack a bunch of chairs all the way to the ceiling without them falling down. And I found out that he was doing this in the bars around town, and so I invited him to come in and do it for 5 minutes. And so he stacked up a bunch of chairs, and he had one left, and we're all kind of cheering him on, and he sits in the chair and falls off the chair, and that was the end of the piece. And I was very successful. So, I do is I kind of like make sure that it's done within about a 5 to 7 minute stretch, and I have them come in and rehearse it a little bit, and I kind of say, hey, you know, go this way or go that way, and I kind of help direct it.
I was going to ask about as a director, is it collaborative, or they come to you with the idea and then you help execute it, or?
Yes, that's exactly right. I have them the way I don't like to sit and do auditions. So I've always been uncomfortable with that. So what I do is I have everybody send, each artist sends me a DVD, a disc, and I see it, and then I call them back and say it doesn't fit in, or I'm going to match you up with someone else. I try to make the evening a wide range evening, which means things, each piece is different. And one of the initial ideas for doing it for 5 minutes is that I felt that if somebody didn't like something, they'd wait 5 minutes and go for another piece.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a 35 or 40 or 50 minute piece. By the way, when I was first starting at performances in the late 60s and early 70s, one of the problems that was in performance art, and they were done by people coming, they were painters basically in the studio, that they had no idea about timing. And they would go on and on and on, and you could figure the piece out in 5 or 10 minutes, and the artist would be up there in front of the audience for 35, 40, 50 minutes, and the audience would basically leave. So it was so then I decided to start teaching it and giving it some kind of like credibility, mm-hmm. and some kind of teaching these artists that it's not basically studio practices, but it's up in front of a live audience.
And that less is more. Yeah, less is more. Because,
Yeah, well, okay. Or more or less. Okay.
So, John, let's talk a little bit about the Sylvia White Gallery, because folks may know you from your prior location in the Southern California and not know that you have reincarnated yourself in the city of Ventura.
Oh, reincarnated. That's cute. Well, that's clever. That's cute. Not cute, but clever. Well, we if I can, and Sylvia, of course, has her own way of explaining it, but we came up here, we were living, and I had my studio, and we were living in Agoura Hills, where it was 104 degrees for about a week and a half, 2 weeks, and so we decided to take off and get a breather. So we came up the coast. We knew nothing about Ventura, but we'd heard it was a, motorcycle town, basically. Mm-hmm. And so we pulled off on Seward, came down the street, and this guy opened up these doors. And Sylvia had just retired from the gallery scene in Santa Monica. And this guy opened up these doors on this building, and we stopped, and she said, my God, that would have been a wonderful gallery. Well, we walked in, and within a week we had purchased the building, and Sylvia had stopped being retired for a couple of months, okay, and opened up the space. And there was room for me. So I have a painting studio in the back, and she has her offices, and then there's a great, it's 5,000 square, so it's about 3,000, 4,000 feet of show space. And we start showing, quality work around the world, actually, some international shows, some local shows, people from New York, well-known and unknown. And the artists have basically really loved us because it was a legitimate gallery.
Mm-hmm.
The way I kind of promoted is what I'm telling people is like a New York gallery sitting here in Ventura.
Well, and okay. So that's what I want. Since we're on the World Wide Web, I don't want people to think that, we're talking about a very niche thing. I just wanted to be able to promote. I love the arts, and I've been to your gallery, and I'm on your email list, which is how I got wind of this 5x5x5.
Uh-huh.
And so it's tomorrow night, Friday, May 10th. It's at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
And then
it's the first time. It's never not. We usually do it on the first Friday, but the special event is my daughter coming up from Texas to do something live besides myself and some other people. So, and May 10th celebrates our fifth year here, an anniversary.
And
so
birthday.
It all kind of, and then it happens to be my birthday. Ha ha. Okay.
So we get
so a lot of fives there. Okay.
Yes.
So.
And then it says plan to stay for cupcakes and champagne.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Okay.
And we do that anyway. This is how I work it. I don't pay the artist, which is really interesting, but I have them, I have someone document their piece on the videotape, and they get a disc.
Nice.
They have a good audience. The audiences are really, 60 or 70 people come in. It's a nice group. They're very supportive. And then we have refreshments after, and they can mostly, hang around with the artist and find out if they didn't understand the piece, why the artist was doing what they were doing.
Oh, nice.
The artists stay around. And it's kind of, it's nice that way. I'd like to back up just quickly. How it got started was that we were up here, and then we joined the First Friday people. It's an organization
John, we're going to have to continue this conversation at another time because we're out
of
time.
Oh, okay.
But,
oh, sorry.
But, no,
okay.
That's all right. Give contact information, please.
At 1783 East Main Street, it's the Sylvia White Gallery, and it's 8 o'clock on Friday night.
And your website?
Yeah, but don't ask me
okay.
to give it to you.
All right. So, John, thank you for your time.
Sylvia.
Okay. And an early happy birthday to you. John White of the Sylvia White Gallery. Again, if you have an event that you'd like to help promote on the show, we're all ears. This is the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate your ears. Have a great day. We look forward to visiting with you tomorrow morning.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.